Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
So I said, who are we playing with? And he said, oh, you're playing with TJ Gardner. I said, I don't. He says, oh, he's a 10-year-old kid. He kills it. He hits it so well. He's a 10-year-old kid. And he plays the Golds, and you're going to play on the Golds. I said, oh, great. And I walked away laughing out loud that this is my destiny in life, to be beaten by 15 shots by a 10-year-old kid from the same tees.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
From Jim Downey in Lake Orion or Lake Orion in Michigan. 21 handicap versus the 10-year-old kid. Forget the smoke. Code purple means press the bet, kid. So we're going to get to that in a second. I just wanted to get to this first because I always enjoy these particular emails. Tom Mule in Bowie, Maryland. Since we are now in June, I thought I would update you again on the sunrise and sunset times in the D.C. area as we approach the summer solstice. Don't worry, June 21st will still be the longest day with 14 hours, 53 minutes, and 53 seconds of daylight. Sunrises have been getting earlier and earlier since January 5th. The earliest sunrise will be on June 14th. That's tomorrow or the next day? June 14th at 5:42 a.m. in the D.C. area. June 7th through the 20th will have sunrises in the 5:42 minute, but June 14th, 1 week before the solstice, will be the earliest. So I guess that's in seconds. I guess it changes by seconds. Sunsets have been getting later since December 7th in the D.C. area. The latest sunset will be on June 28th at 8:37 p.m. Similar to sunrises, sunsets will be in the 8:37 minute between June 22nd and July 3rd, with the latest on June 28th, that is 1 week after the solstice. I will mail again in about 6 months when we approach the winter solstice to make sure you are properly prepared. If not already taken, I would like to be designated as a solstice sunrise and sunset monitor for the Tony Kornheiser Show, which is done.
Yes, so, absolutely.
I just love that the email, it just confirms everything that we talk about on our way to the show in the morning.
Yeah. When look at the sun. It's
sun
up early.
Is up so early. It's
all right, brilliant. So let's get to the golf tournament and TJ Gardner. And let me also acknowledge that his uncle is a good friend of Matt Kelleher's. So Kelleher called me the other day before the tournament. And he said, I just got to tell you this about the kid's uncle that he played with. He played nine with him. And TJ shot 39-9. I said, I'm doomed. I can't play. So we played with TJ and his dad, and we enjoyed it enormously, did we not?
I had a great day, and it had nothing to do with my own golf. To me, so much about this event is looking forwards and backwards, and you see it from as soon as you walk onto the practice tee to when you're on the course, just seeing the relationship between dads and sons.
And you are looking forward, of course, to your sons
playing with you,
being bounced and just sitting in the cart
because
I'm too old. Yeah, maybe I'll putt.
So hit it.
Yeah, or maybe I'll putt. So we played, and would you describe how we usually play together and stop talking very early?
Normally by the third hole, there's been, you know, birdie or two, there's been a bogey, and we go into silent mode for the remainder of the front nine, and we finally get to the second nine. Hello, friends. We realize we have shot ourselves out of it,
no, we're done.
And we return. There's no embrace, but there's a knowing nod that says, we can do this.
Yeah.
And we battle our way to, you know, fourth or fifth gross.
Yeah, so we do something fairly good at some point. So the moment when I knew I was done as a golfer in this particular tournament came very early. Came in the second hole. We are playing, TJ and I, and again, he's 10. And he's, what I admired most about him is he has his routine down. He has the practice swing. He has the grip. He has the breath. He's, you know, he doesn't take nines. You know what I mean?
Right.
He's a player.
Right.
You can tell.
He understands the process, but it's not. He's not overwhelmed by it.
Right.
Again, he's 10.
He's 10. So on the tee, on the gold tees, on the second hole, I regularly get it down to the bottom. I can still hit it long enough and straight enough to get it down to the bottom. It's my best hole on the course. And I, you know, TJ hit before me because they won the first hole. TJ had the honor. So he hit before me, and he hit it pretty good. I thought he hit it pretty good. I killed it. I killed it. Mm-hmm. I'm down at the bottom. There's one ball down at the bottom. It's me. And Tamika, who is our four caddy, sees a ball 60 yards up.
Yeah, halfway up the hill.
Halfway up the hill, 60 yards up in the rough on the left. And she goes, I think this is you. And I go, no, I'm at the bottom. And she says, Titleist 75? I go, yeah. Yeah. He hit it 60 yards past me on the hole where I killed it.
So he didn't even give you the courtesy of checking. He knew where his was.
Yeah, I just walked straight to it.
So I was doomed. He birdied the hole. Natural birdie. A 10-year-old kid.
Wow.
Natural birdie. He also chipped in on 16 from above the hole. This is like one of the hardest shots in golf.
So I would say that you're focusing on the fact that he's killing the ball off the tee. He hits, so on number two, he hits
everything in the air.
Delicate pitch shot from a tight downhill lie that's a spotty lie to a front pin.
Yeah.
To about 5 feet and makes a tricky downhiller on 16. He is behind the green. He misses
everything
the chip.
Goes in the water on 16 on a chip.
He does not miss a beat. He then proceeds to chip in, and he has all the golf vocabulary. It's about time, or you know, he's rooting for you.
Yeah.
Oh, see, I know he probably didn't do this, but I hope he was like condescending, like, no, that's a good shot, you know.
And, no. No.
Give you some tips.
And we were Michael and I were not great on the front. We were one over. We were 36 on the front, but on the back. One of us got hot, right? Fair to say.
Tony caught fire.
Yeah.
The par three
really?
Specialist came out.
I had three pars and a birdie. I birdied 17 with a long putt. Birdied 17. And we finished 36-30. So that's 66. So we're four under. And we got some small amount of shop credit.
Shop credit.
Yeah, we got some small amount of shop credit, which was really good.
That's great.
Yeah, so I felt it was wonderful. I had a wonderful, wonderful time because it was a gorgeous day. Except for the two par fives where I was six over or something like that. I played fine.
Yeah, you played great, and we talked about you played just fine out of the bunkers.
Yeah.
I, on the other hand, hit every single bunker, lost bunkers number five. I was in every single trap.
Yeah.
Trap to trap to trap. It was frustrating. Golf was frustrating, but it's just a reminder that there's so much more about that day than the golf.
It was totally wonderful. And speaking of golf, I don't know how many people who are listening to this saw this yesterday. The Canadian Open. Now, I watched a lot of the Canadian Open from about once the Nats had Dominic Smith hit a home run.
Really?
A two-run home run.
444 feet, longest of his career.
He hit a two-run home run. Now, it was the one that gave them the cushion to get to 6-2. It was not the two-run home run that got them the lead to 4-2. But he is now on pace for as many as 6 home runs this year.
Power surge.
And 40 RBI.
Wow. Now, not to get a sidetrack, did you see the kid for the Orioles, the home run he hit?
Did not.
It was on the Utah Street.
Oh,
I mean,
boy.
It was like 467 feet. I mean, it was a smash.
Oh,
I mean,
good.
Griffey, because Griffey hit it
Griffey off the
yeah.
Off the
I mean, it was in that neighborhood. It was just thunderous.
That's great to know.
Yeah.
So, after that, I start watching the Canadian Open. I have no rooting interest in the Canadian Open, but it's golf, and I like to watch. It's pleasant for me. I watch, and I watch for a couple of hours. And Nick Taylor is in the lead. Nick Taylor birdies 17, birdies 18 with a great 15-foot downhill putt. And so he's one stroke or two strokes up on Tommy Fleetwood. Tommy Fleetwood hits an approach to 16, 2 feet, 1 foot, knocks it in birdie. Birdies 17, they're tied. They finish on a par five. I assume Tommy Fleetwood is going to win. Tommy Fleetwood, by the way, do you know what his nickname is? You know what he looks like?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
Okay. He's got long hair. He's compactly built. Michael, he can't be more than 5'10".
Yep, 5'10".
Something like that.
Sure.
His nickname is Fairway Jesus. It's a fabulous, fabulous nickname. And from 120 yards in, he's one of the best in the game.
Very controlled iron swing, has that cutoff follow through.
One of the best in the game.
A lot of people didn't really know about him until he partnered up with Molinari at the Ryder Cup
a couple years ago. Yeah, the Ryder Cup. So he pars 18. He doesn't birdie. And then they go through a series of overtime holes. Nick Taylor from Canada. Like, everybody wants him to win.
And this is sudden death?
This is sudden death. They go through 18 again. They don't do very well. They go through 18 again. Tommy Fleetwood hits it into the crowd, into the stands, off the course into the stands, and just gets a regular drop because that's a man-made obstruction. If there's no man-made obstruction there, he's 60 yards past the hole. Anyway, They both make the putts they have to make. They both miss the putts they were going to miss. And they go one, then they go to a par three. They're both on the right-hand side above the hole. They both miss on birdies. And then they go one more time to 18. And Nick Taylor hits a second shot onto the green 80 feet away. Tommy Fleetwood hits again into a bad situation where he has to chip. But he chips his third shot. He chips to 12 feet. He's got a very reasonable chance, maybe 10 feet. He's got a very reasonable chance at birdie. And I write to people who I'm writing to, like Norby, for example. I write, I think that Fleetwood is going to be closer on the birdie putt than Nick Taylor is going to be. Nick Taylor's got an eagle putt from what I think is 80 feet and what they say is 72 feet.
Or likely that Fleetwood might be able to, you know, be the first person in if he's,
that's,
you know,
right.
if Taylor has to mark it 5 feet or
that's
so.
That's right. That's right. And I think that we're going again. He knocks it in for eagle from 72 feet, 6 inches away. It is one of the most stunning endings I've ever seen. It is the long, they say it's the longest putt of his life. And he is relatively speechless afterwards.
I'm sure.
And I don't think he will ever have a moment.
How was Nance? Was Nance speechless?
No, he was not speechless. Nance said at one point, it's one of the greatest moments in Canadian sports history. And I wrote down 15 different hockey moments and a walk-off home run by the Blue Jays.
Such a multi-joke.
And Ben Johnson beating Carl Lewis. But okay. Certainly in golf. It's probably Mike Weir winning the Masters.
Yep. Yeah.
Maybe Mike Weir winning the Masters.
72 feet, though?
72 feet,
that's
6 inches. And I will tell you that even if he wins a major, I don't believe he will have a greater moment ever in golf because he's Canadian
and that's their
open.
Yeah.
I don't believe he will.
Now, did you see what I
missed the best moment.
Yeah, did you see what happened right after that? Apparently, there was one of his countrymen.
Adam Hadwin got knocked down by security guards.
Taken out.
Yeah, it was like Mike Curtis.
He's popping champagne.
It was like Mike Curtis taking out that guy, you know, walked onto the Baltimore Stadium.
Yes.
Yeah. Adam Hadwin may be hurt.
Apparently, he's fine. And
was coming out with champagne, and he got decked.
And somebody tweeted out that in typical Canadian fashion, he apologized for being tackled.
So it was really, it was a lovely thing. And
that's great.
I know you've seen the clip, but you were feeding the kids.
This was bedtime, so I followed along. I checked up with it afterwards. But again, it's the highlight.
Yeah.
And then the videos that people have made about this say, like, NFL films wish they could get this.
Boom. Yeah, Mike Curtis for Baltimore when he decked that guy.
I remember that. Yes.
So I had a wonderful weekend. I got to see my son and his wife and their children and their aunt, Kate. And they, you know, came over. It was lovely. I was really pleased, really happy. Everything went well except for the fact that I'm just too old. I'm just too old. We'll take a break. Michael Wilbon, when we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is sent to us by Michael Corey, the regional program manager in Detroit. He says, for 13 years, I had the gift of working at Detroit Cristo Rey High School, where I had the opportunity to interact with some amazing young women and men in Southwest Detroit. Though I retired 2 years ago, I'm still in contact with many of the alumni as they finish college and look to begin their careers. As I mentioned, the students were amazing, but one who really stood out was Camilla Isabella Cantu. She's one of our top students, then went on to earn her degree at the University of Michigan. While she was earning top grades in high school and college, she also founded Mariachi Femenil Detroit, Michigan's first all-female mariachi band. Recently, she released some solo work, including So Far Gone. She describes it as a smooth, modern bolero-like song with soft, whispery vocals and live instrumentation to give it a Latin feel. I just describe it as beautiful. This is Camilla Cantu. The name of the song is So Far Gone, and it plays in Michael Wilbon. And there's a lot of things we can talk about. We got to talk about how both series feel over, and we've got to talk about Djokovic, and we've got to talk about the golf playoffs, so we'll take them pretty much in that order. Both series feel over. The 3-1 teams going home, it feels like, Mike, in hockey and in basketball, they're going to win. Does it not?
Well, it's only basketball it does. Hockey, I don't know. It's a one-goal game. The second win.
Yeah.
For Vegas wasn't, but this was a one-goal win. I don't know that that's over. And the Panthers and the Heat, they have this thing that they just sort of, they're defiant, and that's the spirit of the ball club in each case. I think the one in Denver is, but you know what? If we think that Denver's great and the Joker is sort of invincible at home in a situation where the franchise has never won and blah, 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 and all those things, I subscribe to them. And I started thinking the other day, actually somebody reminded me, Michael Jordan lost 3 clinch games at home. Well, not all at home. He lost 3 games that they could have clinched the championship in game 5. The Bulls, the great Bulls. 3 times. I know one of them was in Seattle because they were up 3-0 and lost 2 games. Another time that, one of the drama of the Utah Jazz series was that the Bulls lost game 5 at home and had to go to Salt Lake to win game 6 back when it was 2-3-2. And they lost game 5 at home knowing they had to play 6-7 in Salt Lake. And then I forget the other one. I don't know what the other one was. It wasn't Lakers. It wasn't Phoenix. Phoenix. That was the game where Charles comes in and writes on the board, save the city. I don't want to see Chicago burn for the celebration that was sure to come. I don't want to see it burn. Let's save the city. And Chuck himself just willed them to a game 5 win in Chicago. And the Bulls had to go win game 6 in Phoenix. So this is what we're talking about. This is that circumstance now. It looks like it's over, but I don't want to go to the betting window.
I just think that one team is significantly bigger and stronger and better than the other team. And no knock on Miami. Miami got here by being an 8. Miami has to be able to, mathematically, you have to be able to win on the road to get to the finals if you're an 8. To get to the next series if you're an 8, you have to be able to do it. But I know you thought after game 2 that Miami had gotten into Denver's heads. Yeah. And I think Michael Malone, the coach there, runs a pretty good ship. Yeah. I think he knows his players pretty well. That's why I sort of like them to win. What do you think?
Well, he knew that win here in Denver by Miami was significant, and he wanted to, ward off more evil.
Yeah.
But, Tony, you mentioned bigger, stronger. Milwaukee not bigger, stronger than Miami?
Yes, they are. Yes.
Not bigger, stronger. They all are.
Well, Boston is not that much bigger and stronger. Boston's not a big team.
Yeah. Boston's got Robert Williams and Jason Tatum. No, those guys are – Robert Williams is a shot-blocking beast. Miami doesn't have anybody like that. And so now at Al Horford, Boston elected not to play its big lineup a lot, but that's on them. Do I think this is it? Yeah, I even packed like this is it. I left stuff in Chicago that I figure I won't need, and I brought enough to get me. I may have to do a little purchasing, have somebody send something straight to Miami to wear. But yeah, I think it's over, Tony. But again, I've did too many times. Golden State did this a time. The great Warriors teams, they did this a time or two where, they're up. The Golden State was up 3-1. Now, the league suspended Draymond Green and that game 5 went awry. But I'm just talking about stuff I remember that I've been a part of covering in the last 30 years. So there's way more than that. But I think this is it.
Okay, I do too. And I was really impressed the other day when we had Tim Legler on, and Tim Legler said that Nikola Jokic is the greatest offensive big man ever. Ever.
Yeah, I'm not ready to go there yet.
Wasn't that remarkable?
I'm not willing to go there yet. Akeem Olajuwon had some lines that I've been looking at recently. There was a game in which Akeem had 38 points, 19 rebounds, 7 assists, 7 steals. It's been, the Jokic is the bit. Look, I've been saying for a month, 2 months, playoffs are 2 months long. The Joker's the best player in the world. He is. But best big man ever. I mean, that game's where Shaq had 40s and 20s in the finals. I can't even get into Wilton Russell.
Well, Russell wasn't an offensive player.
You take Russell out, but offensive, you've got to have Wilt in.
Yeah, of course.
And I, you know, again, when you mention and Kareem, when you mention Olajuwon, people forget it was 2 years. There were 2 years in which the product was not very appealing and attractive. But I'm talking about the product overall, not Olajuwon himself and what he did. And basketball was brutally physical and inartistic and all these things. But Hakeem Olajuwon, come on, man. Hakeem put Shaq in his pocket and swept him.
Yeah. No, he did.
So I'm not going.
Okay.
Anybody on the other side, anybody in the Miami uniform look like Shaq to you?
No. No. God, no.
Hakeem put him in his pocket.
No, he – well, Hakeem Olajuwon was a great player. Let me get off this. Let me get to the tennis.
Yeah.
I know you are surprised by this. You thought Alcaraz would win. Alcaraz cramped up.
Yeah.
Alcaraz and Ruud will beat Djokovic someday, but not now.
Yeah.
Djokovic now has 23. I don't like him, as you know that I don't like him, but right. I believe that you will make the case that he's the greatest male player ever.
It's easy. It's easy to make. I don't know that I believe it, but right. The case is easy to make. Because I thought about this because we're gonna get into this, and this is something I'm gonna have to do this morning before we go on the air this afternoon. I mean, I need to check his head-to-head records against Nadal and Federer.
I think he's better.
Okay, then if he's better than them,
yeah,
this is not like he's better than, you know, some dude who's really terrific, but Medvedev. It's not that. No. If he's better than them, what the hell are they playing the games for? What are we talking about here? So, yeah, it's easy to make the case. And Federer might be third because Federer's owned wholly. You think that that Aaron Rodgers owns the Bears? Come on. Nadal owns Federer. It's something like 24-16.
Yeah, I got Laver first because I'm old.
And... I mean, now Laver's not in this anymore. And I remember Laver's career. You may be older than me, but I remember all of Laver's career, all of it. And I know Laver played against great players. And I used to be able to make the case for Laver. It's too much out there. It's all surfaces for Nadal, Federer, and obviously Nadal had more on clay and Federer had more on grass. Joker, Tony, if his head to head is superior to both of them.
So it's what is interesting to me.
He's a slam leader. What the hell?
Yeah, that's interesting to me. Now I will never have him equal to Laver. Me personally, I will never have him ahead of Borg. I will never have him ahead of Sampras. That's just me personally. But if you take away the tournament where he had the most success, the Australian, he still has more majors than if you take away the most successful thing from Nadal, obviously the French, if you take away the most successful thing from Sampras, from Federer, Djokovic has more without that by far than everybody else. So that is the case that I would make for him.
He's bigger and faster and stronger. He is...
Yeah.
His game is more varied. I was watching. I couldn't see Alcaraz because I was traveling or in a game or something. I don't know what would have been in the game, but I was traveling. I watched the final. And it just points. There's just points where Joker manufactures shots. He's almost as brilliant playing angles as Federer, who is the best at that. And Tony, look. You know, for me, I saw all of Borg's career. I saw all of McEnroe's career. I saw all of Sampras's career.
Me too. Yeah.
Some of that I saw in person. Those guys aren't as good as Joker. They're just not as good.
No, I hate to hear that. But I'll give you, here's the note that Nigel just got. Djokovic 30-29 over Nadal. Djokovic 27-23 over Federer.
Come on now.
No, I mean, you can do it. In other words, I can't refute it. Except by saying, I don't believe it. You know what I mean? That's what I'm left with. I don't have anything else. All right, let's move.
I get it.
Golf playoff. Canadian Open. How great was that?
Great. It was great. That's the best thing in golf this year. Don't tell me, but what about Augusta National? What about the players? I don't want to hear it. That was the most dramatic, satisfying, and I don't mean just because the Canadian kid won, because I like Tommy Fleetwood. If it was anybody else, I'd have been rooting for him to win. But the drama of it, there was both great shot making, putt dropping, choking. It had everything in it that you would want golf to have. I mean, it went from having a little bit of Tiger at moments to Vanderbilt. It was just great.
What did you think when Fleetwood on the second playoff hole hit it into the stands?
Yeah.
Like it hit a girl in the head, basically.
Yeah.
You go, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the relief rules and the penalties are far greater for weekend golfers than they are for professionals.
Yes.
That's a story for another day. But that was so great, man. I got to watch more golf yesterday than the entire spring because I'm a little busy on Sunday afternoon starting in March. I watched all that because it was 50 degrees in Chicago and raining sideways.
Oh.
So I didn't leave my apartment. There was nothing else for me to do.
I couldn't. I thought that Fleetwood's reaction was the best. He just smiled. He doesn't even get to make a birdie putt. Other guy knocks it in for eagle.
Other guy, it was just, you know, what was it, 72 feet or something?
72 feet, 6 inches.
Feet, his longest putt of his career.
It's great.
Longest made putt.
Great.
So, yeah, man, I thought that, you know, on a Sunday where there's things going on that I'm not going to watch. I'm not going to watch a bunch of auto racing, whatever is going on. I might catch snippets. I'm not going to watch any alleged professional football, not one snap of it.
You might have watched the Cubs lose. They lost again.
No, I didn't watch the Cubs lose. No, I didn't. Baseball to me starts, you know, after the All-Star break. It certainly starts after the NBA Finals. And I'll catch a little. You know, I've watched the Cubs. How many games have Major League Baseball played now? 45?
Oh, no, they're up to 60, Mike.
Okay, so out of 60 Cub games, I've watched 25. Hmm. But I don't watch in earnest until August 1st, unless
that's fair.
The Cubs are.
I watch in earnest.
Having a great season.
But I, you know, I think after the All-Star game is fair. All right, I'll talk to you later. Enjoy the game tonight. We'll talk about it.
All right, Tom.
Michael Wilbon, boys and girls, we'll take a break. Pat Forty will join us when we return. We got a bunch of, they're small things, but to me, they're very interesting things to talk to Pat Forty about. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is sent to us by Phil Lentz, and he writes, on the recommendation of a mutual friend, Chuck Todd, here's a song from my recent CD you may like to use on your show. By way of background, I was a political journalist for many years, which is how I met Chuck, then went into politics as a press secretary and speechwriter, all the while writing music. How nice is that?
This is great.
This is called Bluesy.
And I'd say this is a wonderful song, but you know what it could use? Just a little bit of a French horn.
A French horn.
Yeah.
My Chuck could yeah. get in a session and just overdub some French horn stuff. Michael, if people like Phil Lentz, who's had a varied career, want to send us their original music, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonycornozzoshow.com. And it is U.S. Open week. We're also celebrating the captain turning one later this week. So TK Captain 1 gets you a nice little discount at Johnny O. Celebrate all the dads in your life.
Johnny O has great stuff.
Yes, they do.
Wonderful stuff. Pat Forty joins us now. There's a million different small things to talk about. And I want to mention at least that the Belmont was won by a horse that nobody on this show mentioned called Arcangelo, like Archangel, but Arcangelo. First female trainer to win a Triple Crown, Jenna Antonucci. And that was the headline, except there was no headline in the Washington Post. It was buried. The story was buried. They didn't even have the chart in the Agate page. And that's where the Belmont has sunk to. And so my first question for Pat, who is from Louisville, you know, and knows horses, in light of the Belmont, the Triple Crown now feels almost anachronistic. Is racing going to allow this to continue? I understand what it is, Pat. It's starters not going every fourth day, but going every sixth day. I understand it. But if that's the way it's going to be, is the Triple Crown valid?
Legitimate question, and really has been for quite a while, other than, you know, Bob Baffert having two horses that won the Triple Crown within the last decade that were kind of outliers. First of all, they were excellent horses, but secondly, Baffert's one of the few guys that doesn't mind racing his horses as often as you need to win a Triple Crown. But it's really rare. I mean, this year we had one horse from the Derby run in the Preakness, yeah. And that was Mage, the winner of the Derby, and he only ran really because he won the Derby. If he hadn't, he probably would have skipped it too. And then after he lost that, he didn't show up for the Belmont. Right. So they're so lightly raced. They have so much time, ideally, the trainers want to space out their races that, I mean, I think the Triple Crown absolutely does not work the way it is now. I've been saying for a long time, I would love to see the Derby stay on the first Saturday of May, move the Preakness to the first Saturday of June or Memorial Weekend, and then run the Belmont on 4th of July when the only TV competition is a hot dog eating contest. So, that, I mean, if you want to space it out one per month, and I think maybe garner a little more attention as it goes along instead of people just watching for 5 weeks and watching this mishmash of horses that come and go, I think they have to look at changing the schedule.
I agree with that. And it's, you know, the schedule was arbitrary to begin with, so you can make it arbitrary now, right?
Absolutely. Sure you can. Yeah. And I mean, the horse racing purists are like, oh, you're cheapening the achievement. It can be done. And they're, you know, well, by whom? I mean, again, Bob Baffert did it because he's Bob Baffert, but nobody else has been able to win a Triple Crown since 1970s. And so, you know, I just think that it's more and more unrealistic to expect horses to run three times in 5 weeks. Yeah.
What happened to Churchill Downs? They shut down. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, a bombshell move by them, but it was in response to really an intolerable situation. 12 horses died between late April and late May. And, you know, the one thing that will kill that sport, I mean, it's not the most robustly healthy sport to begin with. The one thing that will absolutely turn people off is dead athletes that you're watching have fatal injuries in front of you. And they have to, I felt like they needed to do a complete shutdown just to examine everything at the track and see if there's some commonality that they can fix. There may not be. This may have been an incredibly bad run of luck, but I think until they know that, they had to do everything they could do. And so they moved their meet to Ellis Park in Henderson, Kentucky, which is outside Evansville. And it was a pretty stunning move to do that.
It's like shutting down Yankee Stadium in the middle of the season. I mean, I know people don't follow horse racing to that degree, but this is Churchill Downs. This isn't some joint, you know, this is Churchill Downs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
these are twin spires, baby, you know.
Yeah, the blow, like, to the tourism industry here, you know, I mean, people can still come and tour facility and go to the Kentucky Derby Museum, but people want to come see races at historic Churchill Downs in the summer. And all the people that work at the track, I mean, it was a pretty big economic blow just to the little ecosystem around the track.
All right, I'll get off this. I'll go to college football. Because there are two small stories, and I understand they're small, but they are fascinating to me. And they have to do with scheduling. One is about the SEC, and one is about the Big Ten. The SEC, there was some push, I think, to maybe add one more conference game, go from 8 to 9. I don't know the ultimate resolution of this, if it has been resolved yet. But my question was always, why should they change at all? They win the national championship every single year. Why should they change?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And they ultimately, they stayed with 8 through this next year, and then they're going to reassess. So they basically kicked the can down the road.
Right.
The thinking about why they should change was, now it's now a 16-team conference, and it seems a bit nonsensical to only play 8 games when you have a conference that big. But to your point, it's working. Don't fix something that isn't broken.
I think it's like 10 of the last 13 championships the SEC has won.
Yeah, including the last 3 in a row by 3 different schools.
Yeah.
Right? Or last four in a row by
three different schools.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the feeling is like, all right, come on. If you're going to take in more schools just so you can make more money, then give the fans better games to watch as opposed to scheduling Citadel and Presbyterian, mm-hmm, Youngstown State. But I think the other thinking behind this is, look, we're going to a 12-team playoff. Strength of schedule is going to matter after you get past the no loss and one loss teams. We want to have the strongest schedules. And so that was part of the push for going to 9. But, you know, they will still probably be very well represented in a 12-team playoff, no matter how many games they play in their league.
The other meaningful division and conference in the country is the Big Ten. They have 9 games, but they are not keeping their divisions. The SEC is keeping their divisions. The Big Ten's not keeping their divisions. What do you think of that?
You know what? I'm of two minds about that. One, look, the Big Ten championship game has generally
stinks.
Been a complete boar burger.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
the team from the East squashes the team from the West,
yes,
every year.
We should point this out, that in the East, for people who don't know this, because the divisions are not called East and West, but in the one division, Penn State, Michigan State, Michigan, Ohio State. So, I mean, those are national championship contenders most of the time, right? So that makes it, when the team from the East plays the team from the West, it's been an average, Pat, of 20 points, the margin.
Yeah, yeah, it has not been a close, compelling game, and that's what they want. And also, going into an expanded playoff era, you want, you know, two or more teams to have,
yes,
a chance to make the playoff, and so, you know, put two good teams in there and improve their strength of schedule. The one thing, like, I will say, and I did not enjoy watching the Big Championship game, but I was happy for, like, Purdue when they would win the division, or, Northwestern would win the division. That's a big thing for those schools and those programs, because that's as good as they can do. But now, you know, those teams are not making any Big Ten Championship game anytime soon.
No, because if you're a football fan, the tantalizing possibility is last week of the season, Ohio State, Michigan. Next week, conference championship, Ohio State, Michigan. Next week, Ohio State, Michigan in an expanded playoff, right? I mean, who wouldn't want that?
Yeah, exactly. No, you're going to, I think, probably, I don't know about routinely, but often get a back-to-back rematch of those two teams,
yeah,
2 weeks in a row, once in somebody's backyard and then once in a neutral site in Indianapolis.
So the larger overall question here to me is that you now have the SEC with the addition of Oklahoma and Texas. They're going to have 16 teams. The Big Ten with the addition of USC and UCLA is going to have 16 teams. Why would you be in any other conference? How do the other conferences exist?
They're trying to figure that out. Huh. This is what college sports has become, is, you know, a lot like like corporate America, where the big get bigger and richer and they try to eat up everything around them.
Yeah.
And destroy the competition, and it's working, especially when you get to look at long-range revenue projections for media rights deals, where those two leagues are going to be making $30 million a year more than the rest of them. I mean, I think it's bad for college athletics. I think it's better as a national sport. I think USC and UCLA going to the or to the Big Ten is absolutely terrible. But business is business, and that's where the money is. Now, you know, the question is, do those conferences want to add anyone else? Right now, it looks like no, unless Notre Dame suddenly changes its mind on independence with a new athletic director coming in next year. That's still not likely. But other than Notre Dame, I don't think there's too many schools out there people have an eye on. North Carolina and Virginia have some appeal because they're in new states for both the SEC and the Big Ten, and they've got cachet, but the ACC deal runs through 2035, so you know they're kind of locked in, and there doesn't seem to be much of a way out, and those conferences are not interested in helping them break a grant of rights like a decade ahead of time.
Right, right. Clemson would be a team that I would think might be okay. I guess there's, I don't know, from the Big 12, I don't know. Without Oklahoma and Texas, I don't know what's popular because Nebraska is not what it used to be, right? I mean, some of these teams are not what they were. They just,
I mean, the Big 12 is a good league, but yeah, there's no curb appeal, so to speak. You know, there's no big market. The TV people are not frothing to get TCU, you know, with a small alumni base in Dallas when they've already got those markets covered from Texas, Texas A&M, what have you. Oklahoma State, same thing. You know, it's like, you know, none of the schools that are left in the Big 12, before you bring in BYU and Cincinnati and so forth, but none of the ones that are in there, as good as those schools may be at athletics, are the main school in their state.
I guess what I would worry about, I think I'd worry if I were the Pac-12. I think I'd worry that Oregon and Washington could leave.
Well, that's a legitimate worry, and that's, everybody's holding their breath waiting to see what the Pac-12 media rights agreement is going to be, which is supposedly coming soon, like maybe by the end of this month. And if it's not a number that is better than like what the Big 12 is putting out, or at least as good, then you start wondering who gets the wandering eye from the Pac-12. And thing is, Oregon and Washington, I think if the Big 10 had wanted them, they would have taken them by now. And that hasn't happened. So I don't know. I think, again, like if Notre Dame just upsets the balance of power, then all of a sudden, all right, well, things are going crazy. Yeah, we'll go to 20 and we'll take Oregon and Washington in the Big Ten. But until that happens, I think that they can just sit there and say, yeah, if we'll break glass in case of emergency if need be, but otherwise we're good.
If they go to 20, if those two go to 20, there is no more college football other than them. There's no more.
Right. I mean, then you might as well have an AFC versus NFC sort of playoff.
Exactly.
And everybody else is out.
All right, plug your podcast for us.
All right, College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel from Yahoo Sports, Ross Dellinger, and myself. You can get it on Apple, Spotify, all those places, and we would love to have you listen to it.
Thank you, Pat.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tony.
Pat Forty, boys and girls, we will come back with email and jingle. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes Tony's mailbag. Get your emails, faxes, and your notes. Here comes Mr. Tony's mailbag. Gonna read some for all of your folks.
That was just submitted one day.
He's coming to D.C. in a few weeks.
Yeah. Oh, he is?
Yeah.
We should see him.
Yes.
Darius Rucker.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, play some golf. Let's take him to Columbia. Let's see if we can do that. Oh, you want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad?
Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area nearest you. Then pop on in and you'll be thrilled. Maybe you'll get the bagel sandwiches like we got today.
Fabulous. Sometimes Nigel tries to stump me with certain rock and roll lyrics. You know, sometimes he does stump me. The other day he said, I'll just give you the first line. And he said, now you've got some diamonds. And I said, and you will have some others. But you better watch your step girl or start living with your mother. So don't play with me because you're playing with fire.
Yes.
Michael Philip Jagger in the lead on that.
Believe you had that.
Thanks to our guests today, Michael Wilbon, Pat Forty. Thanks to our sponsors today, ZipRecruiter and Indochino. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. From Michael Boone in Copan Ruinas in Honduras. My name is Michael Boone. I'm an English teacher and writer, currently living and teaching in Honduras. I lived and taught in Honduras for a few years pre-COVID. Recently, I've returned to what I love to do, teaching English, traveling, and writing poetry. I've been listening to the podcast for several years. I've watched PTI for more than a decade. As you can imagine, Honduras does not have all the comforts of the United States, but the genuine hospitality and welcoming nature of the Honduran people more than make up for it. I teach 11th and 12th grade English and try to create new and fun ways to challenge them. Walking back and forth to school and the market daily, I listened to the show. Then one day it occurred to me to use the podcast as an audio tool for a lesson. Kids didn't know what to think at first, but understood mostly everything except Nigel's accent, and of course Carville threw them for a loop. One day, a student stayed after class and asked sincerely, Mr. Michael, what are they trying to get that man, Saliza, to eat? I couldn't help but smile. I knew I had to tell you guys. The show's a welcome delight so far away from home. Thanks for the laughs and a good-hearted sincerity underlining each show. Alexis Pereira in Queens. This is an old one. Since I last wrote to you, I got married in Queens and got hired to write for a Disney show called Hamster and Gretel. Isn't that a nice title?
I'm interested.
Hamster and Gretel. I guess that technically makes us co-workers. I also have a one-in-a-million story. My mother, Olga, was a nurse at St. Francis Hospital in Long Island. There she was talking to an Indian priest recovering in the ICU. My mother asked him what part of India he was from, since my dad is also Indian. He said, Goa. My mom said, oh, so is my husband. What part of Goa? He said, Margao. My mom said, oh, wow, my husband too. The priest asked what my dad's name was, and she said, George. The priest said, it's not George Pereira, is it? My mom said, yes. The priest nearly had a second heart attack in a week. He was my father's best friend and hadn't seen him in 52 years. really? Wow. Okay. From Clifton Buck, PhD, University of Georgia. The official oceanographer of the Tony Kornheiser Show checking in. I was enjoying Chuck Culpepper's Masters commentary when he quoted the great golf writer Jeff Rude, and I thought, hey, I know that guy. He was at my wedding. We served chicken. It was excellent, but there may have been some parking issues. Anyway, Jeff Rude, or Rudy, is it Rude or Rudy? I think it's Rude. Worked with my then future in-laws at Golf Week up until the mid-2000s. Truthfully, I haven't seen him since, but he gets mentioned around the table from time to time. When told about the mention, the mother of the woman to whom I'm related by marriage said, ha, I don't know about great, though you wouldn't get any argument from him. Woo! The show continues to amaze.
Shots fired.
From hearing emails from my high school English teacher, Mark Feiner, to knowing Tim Kirchner's avocado theme song, which proved useful when he was next to me at the Reagan ticket counter a few years ago, and now another David Aldridge moment. Thanks for the laughs. I'm looking forward to another summer of Tony versus the Squirrels, which we can only hope is moderately more successful than the Nats bullpen versus the hitters on the opposing team. So far,
the Owls are doing their job.
The owls are doing their job so far.
They're creepy. They rotate their head.
They're a little creepy.
From Don Hammock in Biloxi, Mississippi. Dennis Bounds' email from a show a long time ago talked about the Hanson brothers from Slapshot.
Oh,
you mentioned Paul Newman being in that movie, but I have some Washington sports connective tissue related to the noted thespian-turned-salad dressing master. Newman plays Reg Dunlop in the movie, which was filmed in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Former Caps coach Bruce Boudreau was playing for the Johnstown Jets at the time and scores a goal in a playing sequence early in the movie, but his apartment got more screen time than he did. They used it as Reg Dunlop's abode. Yes. And when you see Paul Newman in his pad, that's Boudreau's. Isn't that interesting?
Yes, that's wild.
Yeah. From Matthew Galooly, not that Galooly, no, not different. Jeff Galooly, not him, no. In Rochester, New York. Zweigels, eat it. Hoffman's, don't eat it. Okay, from Matt Weissman in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. You chose the best of the best.
Thank you.
The upstate pretenders can't hold a candle to snappy grillers. From Scott Organic, not that organic, in Vernon, Connecticut. Why does it feel like my not having a one in a million story is actually one in a million? That's sort of interesting. From Michael Winkler. throwing my hat in the ring for the coincidence game. 1,000 years ago, I went to college in a tiny town in east central Wisconsin called Whitewater. Wisconsin Whitewater. Did they have a basketball team? I was a dope and nowhere near ready for college life. The only class I took seriously was my freshman level world history class, where I sat next to a cute girl who I never had the guts to talk to. On the day of the final, back when those things involved handwritten essays in little blue books, I was finishing up my overly long and I'm sure far too detailed test when the cute girl came dashing in for the test. She was an hour late and in a complete panic mode. You know where this is going. Before the aforementioned dope that I was, I washed out of that school. And being the aforementioned dope that I was, I washed out of that school in a year. I bounced around some dead-end jobs for a while, eventually went back to school and graduated with a terminally useless degree in history. Just after my 30th birthday, I met a wonderful woman on a dating website, and we got to talking about the strange coincidence that we went to the same school in the early 90s. She told me a story about our freshman level world history class and how she had written down the wrong time and showed up an hour late. Yeah. 20 years, a ridiculous set of triplets, and a fantastic life late. And I'm still madly in love with a girl who can't tell time. She's still always late, drives me crazy, but she tolerates my nonsense, and that's more than most people get, Michael Winkler.
That's wonderful.
From Patrick Vicencio in Laurel, Maryland. On Friday's podcast, Jason Samino,
Sammy,
indicated that New York's health code was at maroon. Would the next code be maroon and black? If so, New York would be need to get geared up and ready to go. I love that. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Come on now. That means everybody just cool out. Where you cool out, everybody.
Will you go down?